came by here. I will show you the old camps. It seems so long ago. El Pecos. Dawn grayed all day. They drove, with the cattle moving faster owing to a thinning of the grass. And that night they made dry camp, the first of the long drive. Next day they crossed water, and on the third made Dove Creek, a thicketed bottomland with a clear stream held the stock.
That's all the time we have. Thank you for joining us for the Noon Book Hour. We hope you'll join us again tomorrow for our next installment from the Recording Library of West Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Travel Hour, followed by USA Today at 2. This week on the Recording Library of West Texas Radio's Saturday Night Movie, a U.S. Marshal in the Antarctic has to solve a murder in the ice and snow in Whiteout.
It is the most isolated landmass on the planet. There is no permanent population. There is no horizon. No shadows. There is only... white. Nature never intended for you to survive here. But this fall, nature is not the only thing to fear.
Delta 1-1 to base. We're making our final approach.
Carrie Stetko, please call Column at 282.
This is United States Marshal Carrie Stetko, over.
We have a real situation developing.
What happened out there?
We were out looking for meteor samples, and then the radar went off the chart. We hit something big.
Oh my God. What the hell happened here?
I want to evac the base. I've already got two bodies on my hands. I could be stuck here.
Kate Beckinsale and Tom Skerritt star in Whiteout. Audio described. Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 41 with haze. Tonight it will be cloudy with a low in the upper 30s. Then tomorrow clear with a high in the mid-50s. Tomorrow night clear with a low in the low 40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
And for our next article in the experience section of the magazine, we have Happily Ever After. In Denmark, Jonathan Thompson sets off to discover the places that inspired Hans Christian Andersen's magical tales, from castles to cobblestone streets, and to visit a new interactive museum in the writer's hometown. From his room at the top of Gisfeld Gloucester, Hans Christian Andersen looked out at the pillowy green Danish countryside, with its chestnut and poplar trees dotting the fields leading off toward the horizon. Below his window, he could see the mirror-like moat, which contained a little knot of squabbling ducks. It was here, one July afternoon in 1842, that inspiration struck the writer, and the ugly duckling was born. Andersen, who was nicknamed the Perfect Wizard by one of his contemporaries for the way he could weave a tale, achieved fame in the mid-19th century by publishing around 160 fairy tales, many of which went on to become deeply embedded in Western culture, including The Little Mermaid, The Emperor's New Clothes, The Snow Queen, and of course, The Ugly Duckling. Born in Odense on the island of Funen to a shoemaker and a washerwoman, Andersen grew into a literary giant who regularly mingled with members of Danish high society. To preserve his legacy, H.C. Andersen's house, which is H. H.C. Anderson, H.U.S., D.K., a $54 million museum that celebrates his life and work, has opened in Odense. Designed by Kengo Kuma and Associates, the superstar architectural firm behind Tokyo's Olympic Stadium and Copenhagen's forthcoming aquatic center, the museum is in the heart of Old Town, set between half-timbered houses and tight, seemingly miniature cobblestone streets. As I descended a curving ramp into the museum's interior, I had the sense of stepping into one of Anderson's stories. Inside, the writer's life is chronicled through his photographs, drawings, and personal effects, including a series of heartfelt letters he wrote to friends throughout his life. The exhibits tell the story of Anderson's life in a whimsical way. On display are objects like his famous stovepipe hat, size 14 boots, and beloved pen, some of which come to life in the audio tour. The English script was written by Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket. Of course, there are tributes to Anderson's most famous works, too. One exhibit is composed of 20 multicolored mattresses, piled high, in mode to The Princess and the Pea. Another shows a representation of reflections in the Snow Queen's mirror. There's also an extraordinary subterranean room where visitors can gaze up through a water basin to the sky, recalling the Little Mermaid's yearning to be a part of the world above. A satellite to the main museum is the H.C. Anderson Childhood Home, set in the half-timbered yellow house where the writer grew up. Its rooms have been decorated to match the descriptions in his autobiography, showing how poor the family was. Throughout his life, Anderson was a perennial traveler, a self-described, quote, bird of passage. While the museum is a superb introduction to his work, I wanted to understand how he lived. To do that, I had to head into the part of the Danish countryside that was both his home and his inspiration. Using the Hans Christian Andersen Trail app, travelers can see a network of places in the region the writer visited during his life and chart a course between the grand estates and mansions of southern Denmark. There, he would write new stories by day and tell old favorites around the fire by night. The islands in the area have more than 100 castles and stately homes, about 20 of which can be booked for overnight stays. Among the standouts is the 13th century Broholm Castle, or doubles from 192, where Anderson was said to indulge in wine during dinners before sleeping in one of the building's romantic bedrooms. Parentheses, during my stay, I regret to report, I found no pee under my mattress. The trail also features places where the scenic landscape would inspire other stories, including gardens such as Sandrumgard on Funen, and house museums like Egeskov, a well-preserved Renaissance castle surrounded by water. But Gisselfeld, where the ugly duckling swam into being on that July afternoon, has to be the finest of them all. Anderson stayed on the lower floors of the castle. He was terrified of being trapped by fire and traveled with a length of rope in his bag if he needed to escape. But he would write on the top floor. Today, visitors can book a room at a delightful B&B in the old gardener's quarters called Paradisuit, with doubles from 174, and they can dine in the large Orangerie. Anderson's story ends in Copenhagen, where he spent his later life and was ultimately buried. His mark is everywhere, from the statues of his characters sprinkled liberally around the city, there are multiple Little Mermaids, to the namesake suite at his favorite hotel, D'Angleterre, with doubles from 574. Delicht, a Danish term that translates beyond the English delight to an intangible blend of charm and beauty, was Anderson's favorite word, and it's spelled D-E-J-I-L-I-G-T. The great storyteller created a world for himself and his readers, and that was full of it. 200 years later, that world is still waiting to be discovered, whether in the pages of his books or in the castles, towns, and landscapes that gave them life. And we have some photographs. The first is a portrait of Hans Christian Andersen by Carl Hartmann. Another is a photograph of Egeskov Castle, that's in Gevandrup in Denmark, and it's beautiful, a warm, kind of an orangey terracotta colored stone with copper turrets, lots of different roof lines, and it's reflected in the water in front of it. And I see a stone wall. I'm not sure if there's a moat. I think there is a moat. And then there's also an illustration for the Ugly Duckling of this castle and its moat. We also have a photograph of one of the exhibits. It's the Snow Queen's Mirror. And I see two little blonde children, one standing, one seated on the floor. And they're gazing up at what looks to be a geodesic dome, beautifully lit and made of mirrors. Magical indeed, I'm sure. And now for the discovery section of the magazine, and this is entitled Toes in the Sand. The Caribbean is synonymous with plush resorts and swank villas, but those aren't the only choices when it comes to places to stay. Sarah Greaves Gabadon reports on four outdoorsy offerings that will bring you closer to nature without sacrificing creature comforts. First is a cozy trailer in Aruba. One of the most inviting roosts on this diminutive Dutch Caribbean island isn't on popular Palm or Eagle beaches. In fact, it isn't on the beach at all. The first of its kind in the region, Aruba Airstream, is an oasis for travelers in search of seclusion, hitched in the midst of a cacti-studded kumuku, which is desert or outback. Up to four guests can settle into the gleaming and blissfully air-conditioned 30-foot flying cloud model, which sits next to its own saltwater pool, hot tub, and outdoor shower. The owners go the extra mile by providing restaurant and day trip recommendations and have stocked the space with exercise equipment and a telescope for stargazing. You probably want to rent a car to experience Aruba's island attractions and beaches, all of which are within a 20-minute drive. But swinging in the hammocks as iridescent lizards skitter across the breezy pool deck is an equally appealing proposition. And that's arubaairstream.com from $275 per night. Wildlife watching in the Bahamas. Last summer, Atlantis Paradise Island, a destination known for its luxe suites, sprawling casino, and mammoth water park, made an unexpected addition to its high-energy scene. The new Marine Life Camping Adventure, available exclusively to hotel guests, is a dusk-to-dawn experience in the Dolphin Cay area of the resort. Campers check into air-conditioned tents furnished with sofas, rugs, and cushioned cots. Also included, mini-fridges, snack baskets, and wine and beer on request. This is Atlantis, after all. Activities include exclusive behind-the-scenes tours of the property's marine habitats and Royal Towers Fish Hospital, as well as sunset snorkeling and after-dark encounters with turtles, dolphins, and sea lions. AtlantisBahamas.com from $2,500. A seaside camp in Antigua. From November through May, six tents pop up on Valley Church Beach, looking like giant white chocolate Hershey's Kisses and offering a Caribbean camping experience that's just as sweet. The surprisingly spacious accommodations at Wild Lotus Glamping feature wrought iron beds and other reproduction antique furniture, plus outdoor showers surrounded by tropical greenery. Toilets are located in the neighboring restaurant. Solar-powered fairy lights make evenings feel magical, as does the passion fruit rum punch poured at the diminutive beachfront bar. Order barbecue fixings for DIY dinners cooked over your personal grill, and in the morning, enjoy the sublime pleasure of sipping your coffee while walking in the resort's mile-long beach. WildLotusGlamping.com from $325. And finally, a rustic retreat in the British Virgin Islands. Visitors usually discover Anagata, a pancake flat island famous for deserted beaches, flamingos, and the best lobster in the BVI. On a not long enough day trip from Tortola, an hour's boat ride away. Now, Anagata Beach Club allows those smitten with the island's unspoiled beauty to overnight in a one or two bedroom beachfront palapa on stilts, with canvas walls, canopy beds, ensuite bathrooms, Wi-Fi, and hammocks on broad balconies raised over the dunes. The on-site spa makes the experience feel as elevated as the accommodations. AnagataBeachClub.com from $390. Anagata is spelled A-N-E-G-A-D-A. And we do have some photographs of these various things. One is the thatched roof suite at the Anegada Beach Club, and we see the hammock there, and a real thatched roofs. It's beautifully lit, and it's evening, and the warm light is shining down on all very natural furniture and surroundings. Another is of one of those Aruba Airstream, and it's set next to that own small pool, a lovely deck, cactus surrounding all of this area, and I don't see another Airstream or another camping site in this photograph, so it looks as if you have quite a bit of privacy and that the Airstream is by itself with the pergola there, and it is a big Airstream. Looks like you'd have plenty of room. And then finally, we have a photograph of a couple kayaking around Dolphin Cay at the Bahamas Atlantis Paradise Island. And the tents are set up there on the beach, and they're all lit with kind of fairy lights there. So it has a kind of a magical look to it. Next up, Forever Young. One of Florida's most storied resorts is refreshed and ready for its close-up. Heather Greenwood Davis explores the timeless pleasures of the Boca Raton. Try as I might to stifle the sound, my giggles were echoing throughout Spa Palmera. I'd just been served a scoop of mango gelato while neck-deep in a tub of bubbles and orange slices. On my way here, I'd marveled at 50,000 square feet of Moorish tiles, elaborate arches, and gardens reminiscent of Spain's Alhambra Palace, though Alhambra's residents probably weren't lucky enough to experience a tropical fusion ritual bath. That only happens at the Boca Raton. We know the past is our legacy, resort president and CEO Daniel Hostetler told me over breakfast at Sadell's, Andre's 13 to 31, an outpost of the beloved brunch spot from New York's major food group. But the vibe we're going for is historic mansion meets 21st century. The Boca Raton began life as 1926 as the Ritz-Carlton Cloister Inn, designed by architect and Boca Raton city planner Addison Meisner. It changed hands many times over the years, most recently in 2019 to tech billionaire Michael Dell, who charged Hostetler and his team with creating a new vision for the resort's next century. These 200 waterfront acres now have five new hotel concepts. The 294-key cloister, with doubles from 595 in the original inn, has space for large groups and meetings. The tower, from 795, the tallest structure in Boca, has 224 suites and butler service. And the 212-room beach club, from 1051, offers three pools and a private stretch of shoreline. Families will find the comforts of home at the bungalows, from 925, a collection of 58 two-bedroom suites with full kitchens. All offer easy access to the $65 million Harborside Pool Club and its pair of three-story water slides. Those looking for a more grown-up vibe will find that, too. At the adults-only pool, the 1930s-inspired MB Supper Club, price fixed $125, or the elegant and kid-free Yacht Club from $969. With its 112 suites overlooking the 27-slip marina. There were 14 dining venues to choose from, including the mid-century-style Flamingo Grill, entrees 28 to 80, also from Major Food Group. From the moment I entered the Flamingo pink doors, I felt transported to a classic era. Waiters sported pink jackets and Monstera green suspenders. The walls were covered in Floridian floral motif tiles, and the smell of tableside bananas Foster filled the air. And we have some photographs here, the Harborside Pool at the Boca Raton Resort. We have an aerial view of that, and it is shaped, it's just swirling all around like a big amoeba, and then it has little islands in the middle of it with palm trees planted on them. And one of them is large enough to accommodate several chaise lounges, and the other looks to be just the greenery. But what a fun pool. And then we have the supper club. It's darkly lit. I think this was one of those adults-only places. And then we have the lobby of the cloister. It's one of the fully renovated hotels on the property. And it's a beautiful all-white room, coffered ceilings, columns going along
The room is a very large room, potted palms all through it, and very elegant. And it does have a look of maybe the 30s, certainly of an earlier time. And next up is the Toast of Hollywood. Los Angeles society legend Bruce Botsy gets into the spirits game and shares his favorite places around town to catch a buzz. This is by John Wogan. Bruce Botsy is a 21st century Renaissance man. He spent 35 years in leadership at The Palm, the restaurant group his great-grandfather co-founded in 1926. Then, while also caring for Ava, his teenage daughter, with Hollywood agent husband Brian Lourd, he started a podcast, Lunch with Bruce, returning in late 2022 as Table for Two, to interview friends such as Jennifer Aniston, Andy Cohen, and Daniel Craig. Another new passion, the Japanese spirit shochu, which Botsy was introduced to by friend and fellow Angeleno socialite Sandra Baker. The pair traveled to Japan to learn more, which eventually sparked the idea for their own line, Mugen. They consulted with Junko Tsutsumi, the fourth generation CEO of Kyushu Distillery, Sengetsu Shuzu, and one of the few women leaders in Japan's shochu industry. Here, Botsy spotlights the best places to sample the drink, along with a few more LA highlights. The Tower Bar. This is one of the great rooms of Los Angeles, a city institution where I always run into a friend, Botsy says of the restaurant at the Sunset Tower Hotel. We have a signature Mugen cocktail there called Gabe's Witch's Brew, named after the restaurant's legendary maitre d', Gabe Dopet. It's made with our shochu, muddled blueberries, Saint-Germain, lime, and club soda. And that sunsettowerhotel.com, entrees 37 to 69, and we have a photograph of that iconic building. I recognize it from movies. It's the Sunset, Hollywood's Sunset Tower Hotel. Next is San Vicente Bungalows. In 2019, Sunset Tower hotelier Jeff Klein opened this private club in West Hollywood, which has a garden-like setting, great food, and its own Mugen cocktail, the SVB Lemonade, Botsy says. Non-members can book a room at the adjacent Hotel 850 SVB to experience the vibe. And those doubles are from 270. Gigi's. This is a beautifully designed new spot in Hollywood that's small and unassuming, but serves exquisite food. For meat eaters, it's the best. I order the ribeye steak and old school hors d'oeuvres like pigs in a blanket. I threw Mugen's launch party there with my stepdaughter, Billy Lord, and those entrees are 31 to 58. Spago. To me, Wolfgang Puck is the king of restaurateurs. I grew up going to his places, including his Beverly Hills flag shop, where I've been a regular since the 80s. He's still all about elegance and quality, serving the best that California has to offer. WolfgangPuck.com, entrees 26 to 155. The Abbey. If you want to have a great time at a gay bar in L.A., then you have to go down to the Abbey. Owner David Cooley is a community leader in West Hollywood. He's completely changed the scene in WeHo in the past 3 decades. Today, it's a place where people feel safe and included. The Abbey WeHo, WEHO.com. And next up, we have Sense of Place. For Jonsi Birgisson and his three sisters, growing up in the Icelandic town of Mosfellsbier meant boundless freedom, playing among wet evergreens, running along empty roads. Sometimes they would swipe a neighbor's rhubarb, cut off the stalks, and dip them in honey to eat like candy. Decades later, Birgisson is known worldwide as simply Jonsi, the solo artist and lead singer of Sigur Rose. He's also the lead perfumer behind Fischerund, alchemizing the sense memories of life in Iceland into fragrances that incorporate native ingredients like birch tar and Arctic thyme. Mosfellsbier is the setting for number 8, Bursting with Rhubarb and Pine. The brand is a family affair, dreamed up over the dinner table by the creative siblings, Jonsi, Lucha, Inga, and Siguros, and their partners, who are artists too. We're separate, Lucha explains, but we move as a whole. The fisherman's flagship sits on the quiet Reykjavik street it's named after, inside a 19th century wooden house that was once Jonsi's recording studio. The retail space, which also stocks incense, tea, art, and homewares, doubles as a sort of sensory museum, where ambient music plays as visitors sip homemade schnapps and browse whimsical installations like a collection of fictional flowers, a collaboration with the all-women writers' collective Svigaskvald, Imposter Poets. As Vilja puts it, what's beautiful about music and scent is that you hear or breathe it in and you're transported. Our next article is entitled A Place at the Table. A native-led nonprofit is sharing its commitment to indigenous food with a nationally acclaimed restaurant, and that's just part of the story, by Nyla Burton. The country's best new restaurant is a tribute to indigenous cultures across North America, the land, the people, and the tradition of resistance. And Owami, with entrees from 14 to 30, which won the title in the 2022 James Beard Awards, isn't just changing the culinary landscape of Minneapolis. It's also bringing indigenous food traditions finally to the forefront. Chef Sean Sherman, Oglala Lakota, and co-owner Dana Thompson, lineal descendant, Midwakanton, Dakota, Wapitan, Sisseton, work only with foods used in North American pre-colonialization. That means no dairy, wheat, refined sugar, beef, chicken, or pork. Instead, dishes might feature foraged plants, local game and fish, alternative proteins like crickets, and wine and beer from primarily indigenous-owned producers. North American traditional indigenous food systems, the nonprofit Sherman and Thompson started in 2017, has also launched the Indigenous Food Lab, offering cooking and foraging classes as well as training for Native chefs hoping to build their own businesses. There are plenty of opportunities to support other Indigenous-owned projects in the Minneapolis area. After Owami, stopped by Louise Erdick's Birchbark Books, where the Chippewa author stocks works by Indigenous writers in every genre, plus art and artisan jewelry. Order a takeout box lunch at the Gatherings Cafe, entrees $6 to $10, by Dine chef Brian Yassi, while its home at the Minneapolis American Indian Center is being renovated. The restaurant, which will reopen in 2024, has become a destination for dishes like Red Lake walleye tacos, wild rice salad, and bison with heirloom corn polenta. And we have photographs of several of the different dishes. One of them is maple chaga cake. Another is turkey shaginyapi. Another is cricket and seed mix. It looks kind of like a granola. A bison steak. Looks like beef to me. Cooked beautifully, kind of pink, medium rare. And here's a game tartar with blue corn tostadas. And Dana Thompson's caption reads, I grew up deer hunting in northern Minnesota, and hunting is so vital to indigenous sovereignty. When Sean first created a tartar using game meat, I was blown away. It melts in your mouth. Let me add a couple more pages of discoveries here. This one is Meet Me at the Museum Reach. This pedestrian park along the San Antonio River is named for the many cultural institutions that line the banks. It also lines past some of the most exciting hotels, restaurants, and shops Texas has to offer. And this is by Amanda Eyre Ward. The first is Chic Comfort Food Kitchen. In the Pearl District development of the northern end of the Museum Reach, chef owner Jennifer Hua Dobberton has opened the permanent home for Best Quality Daughter, and that's entrees from 11 to 28, her buzzy New Asian American pop-up. Think vegan meat pot stickers and boozy bubble tea. The restaurant occupies the historic Miller House, built in 1904, its interior reimagined with four colorful rooms inspired by the four auspicious beasts, figures from Chinese constellations. Lux Landmark. Design studio Roman and Williams overhauled the 19th century Pearl Brewery to create the 146-room Hotel Emma at Pearl, with doubles from 6:45, which brings luxury to the building's industrial aesthetic. Evening cocktails are hosted in the two-story library. In the lobby, the flywheel of an old generator has been transformed into an art installation. At supper, with entrees from 24 to 70, San Antonio-born chef Jorge Luis Hernandez, formerly of the Michelin two-starred minibar by Jose Andres, draws on the many influences that have shaped this city. Modern South Texas cuisine. One of the city's most ambitious recent openings is Cariqui, at C-A-R-R-I-Q-U-I, entrees 17 to 98. It's an 11,000 square foot restaurant helmed by Chef Jaime Gonzalez. At the end of the 19th century, the landmarked white clapboard building housed a saloon frequented by brewery employees. After an 8-year renovation, it now packs tables with Gulf seafood, barbecue, and Tejano dishes like cabrito and beefsteak barbacoa. Beloved Boutique. At the San Antonio outpost of Texas shirtmaker Dos Carolinos, designer Caroline Matthews stocks her signature handmade guayaberas, the button-front men's shirts worn across Latin America, as well as dresses, pajamas, and her coveted, and frequently sold out, seersucker guayaroba. And that's spelled G-U-A-Y-A-R-O-B-E. Not sure what that is. Buzzy Beer Garden. At the expansive and very popular Elsewhere Bar and Kitchen, entrees 13 to 16, which opened just before the pandemic, you can sit on a porch swing overlooking the river and enjoy spiked lemonade, frozen espresso martinis, and a fried chicken sandwich. Hotel with a View. The Thompson San Antonio Riverwalk, doubles from 449, and that's a Hyatt place, opened in 2021 at the western end of Museum Reach, across the river from the Tobin Center for the Performing Arts. The 20-story tower has 162 pet-friendly, casual yet modern rooms. It also has an impressive art collection, including a Jeff Koons red balloon dog, and three dining venues: Cenote, a pool bar, the rooftop lounge, Moon's Daughters, and Landrace, or L-A-N-D-R-A-C-E, Land Race, entrees 24 to 129, by local celebrity chef Steve McHugh, where seasonal menus are sourced from nearly two dozen Texas producers. And we do have a photograph of one of those guayabera shirts, the button-down men's shirts that we see everywhere in Latin America. And I'm just guessing that the seersucker guayarobe is a bathrobe made of seersucker. Just guess. And finally, in Discoveries, we have Culture Club. This season, the European arts and festival scene is roaring back to life. To help you plan ahead, we've compiled a calendar of the events worth traveling for in dance, theater, music, and design. And I'm afraid it's too late to plan for some of these things, so I'll skip around the ones that are already past, like London's National Theatre Company presentation of Othello, which ran until January 21. Here's something I think you could still plan for. Peter Grimes at l'Opéra National de Paris. More than 75 years after it premiered in London, this Benjamin Britten opera makes its Parisian debut in the hands of British director Deborah Warner. The story of a Suffolk fisherman, sung by Alan Clayton, confronted with the drowning of his apprentice and a village that blames him, the work draws from The Borough by English poet George Crabbe to examine what happens when an individual faces communal outrage. Athens Carnival, or Carnival maybe, that runs February 5 to 26. In the weeks preceding Greek Orthodox Lent, the celebration of Carnival, known as Opakris, echoes the Dionysian festivals of ancient times. In Athens, residents dress in traditional costumes. Parades and performances fill the streets, markets sell candy and baked goods, and outdoor barbecues are replete with pilaf and pork chops. The largest event happens during the final weekend, as I say, till February 26. How about the Berlin International Film Festival? That runs February 16 to 26. Not too much time to plan, but maybe. With around 400 titles, including features and shorts, both mainstream and avant-garde, this annual event is one of the largest film festivals in the world. The highest profile films compete for awards, including the Golden Bear, presented at a gala ceremony. The European Fine Art Fair, Maastricht, M-A-A-S-T-R-I-C-H-T, runs March 11 to 19. Galleries from all over the world come to TIFAF, T-E-F-A-F, in the Dutch city of Maastricht, to show art ranging from Dutch masters to works by rising stars. Past years have resulted in some exciting juxtapositions, with contemporary galleries like Seoul's Ghana Art setting up next to more traditional outfits, like Stair Sainty Gallery of London and Adam Williams Fine Arts of New York. Ballet Zurich presents Anna Karenina, March 19 to April 6. German choreographer Christian Spuck will stage a revival of his 2014 ballet, which debuted in Zurich and has since toured Jerusalem, all the way from Jerusalem and Hong Kong, using movement and music to retell Tolstoy's tale of love, passion, and betrayal. Warsaw National Philharmonic Orchestra concerts, and those run through June 3rd. The crashing of cymbals and blare of horns fill the 1,072-seat Warsaw Philharmonic Hall several times a week, often with the addition of high-profile guest musicians like German cellist Nicholas Alpstedt on January 13 and 14. Alpstedt will serve as both instrumentalist and conductor when the orchestra performs compositions by Haydn, Schumann, and Sandor Varese. And now we go to our features section of the magazine, and the first of those is entitled Starting Fresh. Virgin Gorda has a history of attracting free spirits. Gina Vercesi DiCaprio finds that after two catastrophic hurricanes, this legacy of nonconformist visionary thinking is exactly what helped three iconic resorts bounce back. And the photographs are by Amanda Villarosa. This is a story that begins with a pioneering charter skipper, a modern-day pirate, and a conservation-minded New York financier. It was the early 1960s, and the British Virgin Islands, a lush strand of 50-odd Caribbean islands, islets, and cays, 130 miles east of Puerto Rico, had begun to emerge as a plum destination for sailing and diving. Those pursuits were what drew these men to Virgin Gorda, an 8-square-mile dot of land where they laid the groundwork for some of the region's most legendary resorts. By 1978, a few dozen hotels had popped up throughout the BVI, along with a smattering of bars and restaurants that catered to the hardy sailors renting crew-free vessels in what were the nascent days of the bareboat charter industry. Today, travelers to the BVI can take their pick of accommodations, but three resorts, the Bitter End Yacht Club, Saba Rock, and Rosewood Little Dick's Bay, introduced a blueprint for hospitality in the region, ushering the British Overseas Territory into the era of modern tourism. Early last March, I traveled to the BVI, a place I adore, for a week-long stay on Virgin Gorda. My last trip had been in the spring of 2018, just 7 months after back-to-back hurricanes Irma and Maria had pummeled the archipelago, leaving hillsides covered in nothing but gray-brown trunks and branches. But nature fought back, as it tends to do, and through the window of the twin-engine Piper on this latest visit, I could see that the islands below had once again erupted into leafy abundance. As the little plane cruised northward, away from St. Thomas in the U.S. Virgin Islands, I watched the coastline undulate in sweeping curves, forming the secret bias and sheltered anchorages that sailors have cherished since pirates and privateers roamed these waters in the 17th and 18th centuries. On previous trips, I had experienced the magic of these sailing grounds primarily on charter boats, hopping from island to island, sipping painkiller hot cocktails, and snorkeling around reefs that spread across the ocean floor in Rorschach-like swaths. For days after disembarking, I would feel the motion of the sea when lying in bed at night, a sensation both nostalgic and unnerving. But this time, I'd be based on terra firma, spending a couple of days at each of those bellwether resorts. All three had been decimated by the hurricanes, and each had recently reopened following a full-scale rebuild. I'd come to hear their stories and see how their legacies have been carried into the future. In the late 60s, Basil Simonette, a renegade yacht captain from St. Thomas, settled with his partner on 30 secluded acres of Virgin Gorda's North Shore. He built a handful of Spartan cottages and a pub that became a hangout for his yachting contemporaries and dubbed it the Bitter End, which in nautical speak refers to the end of a boat's line that's tied to the ship. Fittingly, the rustic camp was also the last outpost before the Caribbean met the open waters of the Atlantic Ocean. I first visited the resort in 2002 on a sailing trip with my husband and a group of friends. By then, the resort's current owners, the Hokin family, had spent decades transforming Simonette's ramshackle settlement into the Bitter End Yacht Club, a seaside hamlet with 47 breezy bungalows, a world-renowned sailing school, and a fleet of boats for guests to rent. On our 2018 charter, my family and I motored a dinghy up to the North Sound from nearby Leverick Bay, a cove that, at that time, had the only intact mooring balls in northern Virgin Gorda. Though the entire territory had suffered the hurricane's wrath, the North Sound arguably took the worst beating. The sapphire waters, normally full of boats and thrumming with revelry, were deserted. The Bitter End's waterfront village lay in splintered heaps. The remaining bungalows sagged on a hillside, looking more Dorothy Twister's ravaged Kansas farmhouse than the cherished cottages they'd once been. "It was just totally devastating," Lauren Hokin recently told me over the phone. She runs the property with her father, Richard, who took the helm in the late 90s. "But my dad and I just said, okay, this is what it is right now. We can either walk away or we can move forward." We'd owned the property for 50 years at that point, and it needed some updating, so we thought, well, here's our opportunity. Now, almost 5 years and a pandemic later, it was clear that the revelry had returned. From Virgin Gorda's tiny airport, I took a taxi to the snug settlement of Gun Creek, where one of the Bitter End's rigid inflatable boats waited to dash me across the bay. As we zipped along, I listened to strains of reggae float across the sound on the balmy afternoon breeze. Dozens of sailboats bobbed on shiny new moorings. Dinghies zipped to and fro, and kiteboards and hobbycats skimmed over the sea, their sails billowing with the island's famous trades. The Hokins tailored the first phase of the Bitter End's resurrection to serve the nautical community that put the property on the map, reviving the village, marina, and mooring field so that boaters could once again enjoy the splendor of the North Shore. Visitors like me, who arrive sans yacht, have the option of bunking in one of two waterside bungalows. This airy pair, modeled after traditional sailmaker's lofts, sits on the edge of the marina. Each has a double-decker terrace that juts out over the Caribbean and swim ladders that drop down into the sea. I arrived in time to catch Richard and his wife Wendy at the tail end of a three-week visit. Richard has mastered the art of the sailor's yarn, and over a dinner of crispy conch fritters and fragrant chicken roti in the resort's chic new clubhouse restaurant, he vividly recounted the Bitter End's history. Around the time Simonette set up shop, Richard explained, his parents, Myron and Bernice, began taking regular sailing trips to the North Shore Sound from their winter base in St. Thomas. The couple befriended the eccentric skipper, and one evening over cocktails, Bernice asked if he might sell them a piece of land where they could build a cottage of their own. Simonette upped the ante and offered them the whole place. 3 years of rather unorthodox negotiations followed. At one point, Richard said, Simonette wanted to be paid in gold bullion, and in 1973, the Hokins took ownership. What we didn't realize was that the bareboat industry had started up on Tortola, Richard said of those intervening years. Amateur sailors soon caught wind of the North Shore's magic and began arriving in droves. But those early rental boats lacked the creature comforts of today's elegant charter yachts. "The wannabes weren't accustomed to life aboard a small, crowded yacht," Richard continued. "They started asking if they could rent a cottage so they could have a shower, sleep in a real bed, and indulge in intimate activities that were uncomfortable in two-foot-wide bunks with shipmates in the same space." He smiled and said, I suspect the latter is the principal reason the Bitter End became a resort. In its previous incarnation, the Bitter End offered a robust menu of diversions, including sailing classes, weekly regattas, day trips around the archipelago, and sunset cruises. As the Hokans have rolled out Bitter End 2.0, they've curated a collection of Caribbean experiences inspired by those same adventures. I spent the bulk of my time doing what one is supposed to do at the Bitter End, messing around in boats. I ventured out on a paddleboard to snorkel in a mangrove cove and kayaked to Prickly Pear Island, where I lolled on a Gilligan-style beach among hundreds of pink conch shells. One afternoon, I took my first ever sailing lesson with Joe Lund, a water sports instructor, and for an hour, we coasted through the sound on a 14-foot Hobie wave with the sea spraying our faces. Another morning, I met up with Nick Putnam, the Bitter End's assistant marina and water sports manager, for a snorkeling tour. There's just been this overwhelming feeling that, man, it's so good to be back, he said as we cruised to the Baths National Park. It's taken a long time to get where we are, and it's been a struggle, but here we are, doing what we love to do. He smiled and gestured as the ocean went by in a blur. We picked up a mooring at Devil's Bay, a scimitar of alabaster sand. Later, Putnam and I would investigate the Jurassic warren of saltwater pools and sunlit grottos that define this geological wonder. But first, I wanted to explore the granite metropolis, the boulders formed beneath the sea. Hovering on the surface, I watched a school of sergeant majors glide among sea plumes, while two parrotfish, polychromatic scales glinting, crunched mouthfuls of coral. In the shallows, three iridescent reef squid with comically large eyes observed my progress before disappearing into the aperture between two rocks. Going forward, the Hokans plan to develop the Bitter End in a way that has the lightest possible impact on the environment, bottling their own water, installing solar power, and capitalizing on natural ventilation. Three more waterside bungalows will be built in the coming months, along with a collection of timber frame structures reminiscent of their predecessors. We really tried to preserve the spirit of the place, Richard said. It may look a bit different, but the heart and soul are the same. And those are doubles from 775, and it's BEYC.com. Saba Rock. Just 300 feet across the sound from the Bitter End, yet a world away in vibe, Saba Rock sits like an oasis in the middle of the sea. The one-acre island curls into itself like a nautilus shell, palm trees fringing its perimeter, ultramarine water in every direction. My seat on Saba's little red ferry, which I picked up from the Bitter End, provided an excellent view of the new resort. The two-story structure wraps around the island in a sleek semicircle of storm-proof concrete and honey-colored wood. A dock traces its curves, and dinghies bump up against it, too deep in spots. I could hear the high-energy thump of soca music coming from the restaurant, where a lively lunch crowd filled the tables ringing the water's edge. It seemed I'd arrived just in time for the party. That spirit of bacchanalia has been part of Saba's DNA for decades, originally nurtured by a free-spirited New England expat named Bert Kilbride. He bought Mosquito Island, an uninhabited bump of land off the northern coast of Virgin Gorda, built a 12-room dive resort he named Drake's Anchorage, and spent his days scouring the treacherous reef surrounding Anegada for sunken ships. In 1967, Queen Elizabeth II appointed him Her Majesty's Receiver of Wreck, tasking him with salvaging maritime debris and cementing his reputation as the last pirate of the Caribbean. In 1970, Kilbride moved across North Sound to Saba Rock, which in those days was little more than a windswept volcanic spit covered in dry scrub and organ pipe cactus. He cobbled together a house from stone and driftwood that doubled as headquarters for his new diving venture, Kilbride's Underwater Tours. For decades afterward, curious travelers came calling, intrigued by tales of the treasure hunter who called the rock home. Hurricane Hugo struck in 1989, putting a temporary kibosh on Kilbride's diving business. To make ends meet, he and his wife, Gayla, converted the space into Pirate's Pub, hawking burgers and bushwhackers to passing boaters. In true buccaneer spirit, Kilbride greeted guests who ran the gamut from itinerant old salts to Walter Cronkite with a blue and yellow parrot on his shoulder and chains adorned with gold coins around his leathery neck. The pub flourished until 1997 when Kilbride sold Saba to a restaurateur from Hawaii who rebuilt the place from the ground up, adding a hotel and a smidge of refinement to the island's brand of debauchery. After Irma, billionaire investor Peter Kellner stepped in, working with Czech architect Peter Kola to redesign the place. In each of Saba's 9 guest rooms, sliding doors open to a balcony overlooking the waterscape outside. After unpacking, I walked around the island's perimeter and then, because that took all of 10 minutes, I did it again. This time I slowed down, spiraling up from the pretty beach to the sunset bar and back down again, charmed by the beguiling spaces and nautical design details I encountered along the way. The diminutive island is immensely photogenic, with swings hanging by the upstairs bar, hammocks swaying beneath coconut palms along the water's edge, and British farm booths that add crimson pops to the endless turquoise panorama. Had I been on a sailing charter, my visit would likely have been short-lived. A few minutes in the afternoon watching tarpon being fed from the dock, a rum punch or two at sunset, dinner at the waterfront restaurant, then back to the boat to sleep. In the morning, we would have dropped our mooring and started the long sail up to Anagata, the traditional stop after an overnight in the North Sound. Instead, my 2 days at Saba Rock stretched into a miniature retreat. I rolled out my yoga mat on the Oceanside Pavilion. I had a treatment at the spa that blended massage, essential oils, and a sound bath into an experience so restorative it felt like a hug. One afternoon, I lounged in a hammock and counted the sea turtles popping up from the reef for breath. And whenever I began to feel moored on the island, which in theory I suppose I was, I made my way down a sandy path and dove into the sea. Sabarock.com doubles from 750. And the last resort being featured in this article is Rosewood Little Dick's Bay. From the water, the conical wooden roofs of Rosewood Little Dick's Bay appear to rise from the lush, jasmine-scented foliage like something out of Robinson Crusoe. I presumed the resort was just as Lawrence Rockefeller had envisioned it when he sailed into the idyllic Half Moon Bay in 1958 on board his yacht, the Evening Star. By then, the philanthropist had been on the ecotourism trail for a while, having built resorts like Dorado Beach in Puerto Rico that, in his words, aimed to go to the frontiers of natural beauty and keep them in harmony with the locale. On the pier, I met my butlers, Altamash Khatib and Hubert Hall, who whisked me away for a tour. Walter Prokosh, the resort's original architect, wrote that his goal was to evoke coconut palms in a strong breeze, storm-tossed, irregular, tropical. When Irma left the property literally storm-tossed in 2017, Little Dick's had been on the cusp of unveiling an 18-month refresh. Although the resort's open-air pavilion restaurant, with Prokosh's zigzag of soaring roofs, had been spared, the damage to the rest of the property was catastrophic. All of the rooms were rebuilt on the original foundations, Khatib told me as we looped past the farm, the resort's new organic kitchen garden. The reimagined property exudes a sleek, vintage aesthetic that harks back to Rockefeller's philosophy of keeping the environment intact and the resort itself simple and informal. My suite, a mid-century-style haven with vaulted ceilings and a huge wall fashioned from local stone, sat amid an Eden of frangipani and bougainvillea. Just off the patio, a sandy path snaked beneath a bower of sea grapes to the beach. As I strolled the tawny crescent, I spotted a juvenile black-tipped reef shark cruising the translucent water near my feet. I rose early each morning, wanting to spend every moment possible absorbing my surroundings. Hall made sure I had milk for my tea, which I brewed in a porcelain pot and sipped on the patio while listening to waves lap the sand. Later, I wandered to the pavilion for breakfast, where I devoured plates of ambrosial mango and papaya and far too many chocolate croissants. One day, Khatib arranged for Captain Avery Baptiste to drop me at Little Trunk Bay, a secluded beach not far from the baths, where I swam and sunbathed for hours, living out a castaway fantasy that included the unlikely additions of a gourmet picnic and a chilled bottle of Moet. My bed at Little Dick's was huge and plush, a far cry from the modest bunks of my boating trips. Still, I did miss the mobility that sailing affords. To remedy that, I booked a day on Midnight Moon, a sleek powerboat. As we set off, a brief morning cloudburst left a huge rainbow in its wake. In the distance, the Dogs, three jagged islets known for some of the territory's best snorkeling, rose from the sea. But the current that morning was a bit too rough. Instead, we headed to a tranquil spot called Diamond Reef, where I spotted a surly barracuda lurking near a jetty carpeted in coral. We spent the rest of the day hitting the BVI highlight reel. Sandy Spit, a miniature cay that has almost washed away by the hurricane. Dreamy White Bay on Joost van Dyke, home to the famed Soggy Dollar Bar and a chic new hotel, The Hideout. And Norman Island, where I snorkeled near a triptych of caves said to be the inspiration for Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island. Later that afternoon, as we approached the southern tip of Virgin Gorda on our way back to Little Dick's, I could see the towering boulders of the Baths. I remembered something I'd heard from Elwin Anderson Flax, an 81-year-old lifelong resident who'd given me a history tour earlier in the week. As we wound along the North Sound Road in his pickup truck turned open-air jitney, he shared countless tales of life on the island. The ones that stood out most were his memories of the hurricanes. That morning after Irma, the whole island was gray, he said, and I told myself that for the first time, I was seeing Virgin Gorda as it really is, naked. And with all that nakedness, the beauty of the rocks. Now those rocks peaked above the velvety emerald foliage enveloping the hillside. Snorkelers and sailboats filled Devil's Bay. On the beach, Poor Man's Bar buzzed with the energy of a happy hour that had started before lunch. Virgin Gorda had risen once again. And Rosewood Hotels has doubles from 1,540. And we have some photographs, as you might expect. Rosewood Little Dick's Bay is seen from the water, the rooftops rising out of the palm trees. And here's a shot of the treehouse suite, which looks nothing like a treehouse from the inside, at least. It's all painted white. The ceiling rises up from the ceiling fan. It's very high ceiling. And the walls are painted kind of a warm sand color, white, crisp white sheets on the bed. As I say, nothing treehouse about it. Let's see what else we have here. Some other photographs. There's one of a bright red British phone booth sitting out in the middle of the wooden dock here. I can see the cleats there, the water beyond. So I assume it's a usable dock. And yeah, I suppose boaters need to use the phone once in a while. And there it is, right handy. And then we have some photographs of that Bitter End area there. One is of a floating dock. It looks to me like just a raft, but I do see that there's a cleat on it, a ladder, and there's a woman swimming off that floating dock, otherwise looking like a raft. There's some yachts moored. One has a giant sails. They're not up, but the masts are very large, and the other one doesn't appear to be a sailing yacht. Very nautical, everything I see here. Nautical ropes hanging there, and here's a sitting area on one of the waterfront accommodations, and it all looks to be made out of teak or cypress or some kind of wood that can stand that weather. And one of the bedrooms, and the sheets are all crispy white, the pillows are just fluffy and white, and there's a kind of a gauzy off-white canopy overhead on that bed. And then some photographs from the Saba Rock area. There are hammocks strung between palm trees right up next to the waterside, and some people enjoying them, some also in colorful Adirondack-type chairs. There's a shot of the Saba Rock ferry. It's a bright red boat, kind of a launch, I guess, that would take you back and forth between the different islands and places to enjoy. And then we've got some shots of some food, aerial shots of some food, fish tacos made with mahi-mahi and ceviche, and a Negroni cocktail. I saw one of those in another one of the pictures that was featured at another resort as well. Must be a popular drink in that area. And finally, the rocks at Rosewood Little Dick's Bay. They're the Baths. It's a national park. It's a famous geological formation on Virgin Gorda. And perhaps these are the rocks that that elderly 81-year-old gentleman, the lifelong resident there, had talked about after the hurricane stripped everything away. What was left was the glorious rocks, and these are beautiful.